Island's Hot Stove Show with Glenn Geffner is on.
Tyson fires, Morneau swings, loops one into center field, out goes Etch, a long way out, he dives and makes the catch to save the night.
940 wins.
How about that for thrills?
Miami Sports.
Hey, hello again, everybody. We welcome you to another edition of Marlins Hot Stove. We are now just 39 days away from pitchers and catchers hitting the fields up in Jupiter to start the spring. Got a lot to get to with you over the next 2 hours tonight as we take a look at this Marlins ball club, in a sense, from all three angles. We're going to talk offense. If you read my blog over the weekend, you saw my somewhat outside-the-box proposal for a 2015 Marlins lineup. Want to spend some time sharing my thoughts on what Mike Redmond could choose to do with his batting order, and want to hear from you on what you'd like to see happen as well. Barring injury or something else unforeseen, we know the eight position players who are going to take the field from Miami on opening day, April 6th against the Braves. How do you put those puzzle pieces together in a 1-9 lineup that can generate the most runs scored over the course of 162 games? I've got a suggestion you may find of interest. That is on the agenda here tonight. In addition, talking offense, going to talk pitching tonight. I'll be joined live by Marlins right-handed pitcher Tom Kohler. TK coming off a 10-win, 32-start season in 2014. He fell just shy of 200 innings. And the Marlins hope for all that and more from Kohler here in the new year. Tom Kohler will be my guest later in the show tonight. And if you're going to talk offense and pitching, you better talk defense as well. And we'll do just that with Marlins first base coach and infield instructor Perry Hill. Many will tell you that Perry Hill is the absolute best in the business. He's always fun to talk with. Bone will join me in just a couple of minutes here. Also tonight, going to get some thoughts on these 2015 Marlins from former Marlin and current MLB Network analyst Cliff Floyd. Our Marlins on Deck pregame show host Kyle Seeloff talked to Cliff this week. And with the Hall of Fame class of 2015 announced last Tuesday, Kyle also caught up with my partner, Dave Van Horn. Dave was the voice of the Montreal Expos when a young Pedro Martinez exploded onto the scene north of the border. Look at Dave's reflections on one of the newest electees to the Baseball Hall of Fame, the great Pedro Martinez, coming up a little bit later in the show. Look forward to your contributing here tonight as well. We'll open up the phone lines as the night goes on. In the meantime, you can also join the show by tweeting me or by sending your comments to me via Facebook, my Twitter at Glenn Geffner, Facebook Glenn Geffner. Hope to hear from you over the course of the next 2 hours. So a lot to get to between now and 9 o'clock, but we begin by talking some defense, and we get to do so with the man we always call the best infield instructor in baseball. There may not be anybody in a Marlins uniform more excited about reporting his spring training than Perry Hill, who spends his winters up in Michigan. Coming up on the show tonight, I mentioned all the guests we have. I want to also mention the fact that beginning tonight, we're going to take a look over the course of the next several weeks at each of the Marlins' rivals in the National League East, what they've done this offseason, what their fates look like heading into the 2015 season with a broadcaster or a writer from each of those teams. We're going to start that tour of the National League East tonight with Josh Lewin, one of the radio voices of the New York Mets. He's going to join me later in the show tonight to talk about the Mets, who have had a relatively quiet offseason, bringing Michael Kadire in, but the Mets, a team like the Marlins, hoping to maybe surprise some people and make a big jump here in 2015 after, like the Marlins, they've been building the last couple of years. They feel as though time for patience is over now, time to strike, time to try to win. The Mets and the Marlins, in many respects, in similar boats. So later in the show tonight, I'm going to talk with Josh Lewin, one of the Mets radio voices, about that New York ball club that we'll see a lot over the course of this 2015 season. So a lot to talk with you about over the course of the next 2 hours. We get together every Monday night from 7 to 9 talking Marlins baseball. It's hard to believe we're less than 6 weeks now away from the start of spring training up at Roger Dean Stadium in Jupiter. It has been, for the most part, a quiet week for the Marlins news-wise this past week. Really a quiet time of year where, for the most part, teams get the bulk of their heavy lifting done before the holidays, and now it's just a matter of fine-tuning a little bit and filling in some pieces here and there, the bench, the bullpen, things like that, and we'll wait for some Marlins additions over the course of the next couple of weeks. Three new players for Perry Hill to sink his teeth into over the course of the spring, and put the work joining Danny Echevarria in that Marlins infield. Should be a very good defensive infield. Looking forward to talking to Bone about it at some point here in the next couple of minutes, as soon as we get all the proper buttons pressed here. But you think about Michael Morse at first base, D. Gordon coming over from the Dodgers, the new second baseman, Martin Prado, the veteran third baseman. So three-fourths of that Marlins infield turning over from last season to this season. It'll be a challenge for Bone to make it all work, but we know that the Boneyard will be busy. The half diamond he's got in Jupiter at the Roger Dean Complex there, where a lot of his magic gets worked over the course of the spring. And we'll look forward to, hopefully, at some point here in the next couple of minutes, talking to Perry Hill about just that. In the meantime, do want to remind you about an important date coming up on the calendar. It's not that far off. We started talking about this back before Thanksgiving, and February 21st seemed like it was eons away. Now it's right around the corner. It'll be the 2015 Marlins Winter Warm-Up at Marlins Park on Saturday, February 21st. Bring the family to Marlins Park for a day of fun. You can purchase single-game tickets for the 2015 season. Select your seats for season tickets and mini plans. Get autographs from Marlins players and alumni and enjoy games, activities, music, and entertainment for all ages. Again, that's the annual Marlins Winter Warm-Up. It's coming up Saturday, February 21st at Marlins Park. Hope to see you out there. For more information, go to marlins.com. That is the day every year when you get your first shot at purchasing opening day tickets. If you want to be there April 6th when the Marlins take the field for the first time against the Atlanta Braves here in 2015, whoever your favorite teams are who you like to see when they come into town, you can get those single-game tickets at Winter Warm-Up on February 21st. Let's give this a shot again. Perry Hill, you with us?
I'm here.
There you are. I think you've been here all along. The magic of radio.
No, I couldn't hear you until just about 2 minutes ago.
Okay, well, we're glad we have you now. Let's skip the pleasantries. We've lost a little bit of time. We were talking about how chilly things are up your way in Michigan. Going to get some warm thoughts. Let's talk some baseball with you. I think, Bone, it's as important that we talk about the role defense plays in Major League Baseball now as it's been in a long time. You've got offense declining, runs scored last season at their lowest full-season level since 1972. So more low-scoring games, more tight ball games, which one mistake in the field can cost you a ball game. How good does it make an infield instructor feel that run prevention is getting the attention it deserves as a key to winning ball games right now?
Well, it seems to have gone in cycles, Glenn. It used to be that way a long time ago, and then the 90s, early 2000s, it seems like it was the offensive boom, and now we're back to the original equation that most teams used to model themselves after, and that's pitching and defense.
And O, for you, long before shifting became common practice, defensive positioning has always been critical. For fans who watch closely, when they watch a Marlins game, they'll watch infielders moving around, not just based on who the hitter is, but based on game situations, even based on the count within an at-bat. With each passing season, we see more radical defensive shifts employed across the game. What are your thoughts on the more frequent use of those shifts and some of the more unusual alignments we're seeing these days?
Well, I guess it's became the thing to do here in the last year or two. And it makes sense. You know, a lot of these guys have one swing, no matter what the game situation or the count or, who's pitching. So in those type of hitters, it makes sense to, move people around or get everybody on the one side of the infield, the right or the left side, whatever the case may be. But then you have to keep honest, and some of those hitters that still play the game based on the scoreboard, the count, the pitcher, the score of the game. So those kind of guys, you have to play the conventional honest way. But the shifting is the new thing. But like I said, it makes sense. Most of the hitters, or a lot of the good hitters, will change their swing depending on the game situation. Others will not. You know, coming to my mind right away, guys like Ryan Howard, you know, very seldom will he hit a ball on the ground the other way. So mm-hmm. Those kind of guys, it makes perfectly good sense.
Now, I'm going to guess you're with me on this. I don't know for sure you are, but I prefer a 3-2 game to an 11-10 game. I know a lot of fans, though, would rather see the high-scoring games in the past. You've had the sense MLB likes offense, but as offense has declined now, in part because of these defensive shifts and the strange things people are doing in terms of positioning, there have been a few voices that have suggested that MLB could at some point step in and maybe impose rules that say you can't move infielders to the other side of the diamond, sort of forcing teams to keep their defenders more or less where they've played historically. Could you see that happening?
I haven't heard any rumors to that effect. You know, it's strategy. It's just like how you pitch a hitter. You know, you can't think, you really can't dictate, I'm going to do this to this guy. That's just taking the natural flow of the game out of the players' and coaches' hands. If a guy, if he sees everybody over there, then learn to change your swing and hit it where nobody's there. It can work both ways. So I hope it doesn't come to that. I mean, it's just part of the strategy, my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. I'd much rather see a 3-2, 5-4 type of game, because, that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Marlins first base coach, infield instructor Perry Hill. But let's turn our attention to this Marlins club. A lot of turnover on the infield from last year to this year. You're going to have a newcomer at first base, Michael Morse. You'll have a new second baseman, D. Gordon. Have a new third baseman, Martin Prado, to work with. I know you've got your way of doing things, and those who have played for you over the years swear by your methods. When you add a new member to the infield, and this year you add three, what's the process you go through to get to know exactly what you have to work with, and how long do you wait before you start to tinker a little bit?
Well, usually, we'll go through about a week's worth of drills and spring training, and I'll just watch. And, after about a week, I see what they do, what my philosophies are, get their input, and then we put our heads together and we kind of make it a tweak here or there. But in some cases, you have some players who want to jump right in and say, hey, I haven't felt comfortable in a couple of years. Let's don't waste any time. Now, that's a week that we've lost if you just watch. I know I don't feel right. I know something can be better. Let's just jump in with both feet. So I've had it go both ways.
Now, I haven't talked with Martin Prado yet, but I know in talking with both D. Gordon and Michael Morse, they can't wait to get to work with you. I asked them both if they're ready to go to boot camp in the Boneyard and to work to keep up with you over the course of spring, and they both said kind of the same thing. They said with the work ethic they're going to bring to the table, they hope you're ready to work with them, ready to keep up with them. So that's got to be music to your ears.
Yes, it is. D. Gordon has told me that in several conversations that we've had, that his goal is to wear me out. So we'll see who gives first.
We're talking with Perry Hill, the Marlins' first base coach and infield instructor. Got to take a quick break here. When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about each of the newcomers on your infield. I want to talk to you about Adany Echevarria as well. So, quick break. When we come back, more with Perry Hill. We're making up for lost time here with Bone. Stay with us. This is Marlins Hot Stove on 940 Wins.
Baseball's burning questions all winter long. Winter long. Fire up the stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner on 940 Wins.
Right around third, Ozuna the throw to the plate, and Wright is out at the plate. Ozuna throws out the tying man for the second out of the eighth.
Miami Sports.
Talking baseball until 9 o'clock tonight. Busy show, a lot to get to. We begin tonight with the Marlins' first base coach and infield instructor, Perry Hill. Bone, want to talk a little bit about each of the newcomers on your infield here in 2015. We'll go around the horn. Let's start at first base with Michael Morse. This is a player who signed out of high school as a shortstop, and while he's made about 140 big league starts at first base over the years, most of his action has come in the outfield, especially in recent years. What are the challenges in making sure he's comfortable moving to first base on a full-time basis, really for the first time in his career?
Well, I talked to Mike a couple of weeks ago, and he said he's played a little bit over there, but there's some little nuances and tweaks that we need to pay attention to and kind of iron out. You know, like we've had these conversations on the plane before, Geoff, is that, you know, there's more to it than just running over there and putting your foot on the white thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ton of things to learn to make your job easier, and the first baseman is involved almost every time the ball's hit, you know, whether he receives a throw from one of the infielders or he's got to move on a bunt play or get in position on a cutoff and relay. So, I mean, there's just more to it than just catching a ball. And, you know, a lot of people realize that, but then again, a lot of people do not. And so we've got a lot of work to do. I mean, there's so many things that go into it. First move with a left-handed pitcher, just so many footwork and details that, we'll be able to use all 6 weeks and try to iron things out.
Yeah, I don't think most people realize you can't get to all this stuff over the course of 6 weeks of the spring either. You do a lot of early work on a daily basis, particularly when the team is at home throughout the season, because this teaching, even at the big league level, is ongoing.
Yes, there's probably around 3 to 3:30 every day I'll try to take one infielder out, just one-on-one specialty work, just him and I, to try to keep kind of a maintenance thing. Maybe he's having trouble with something, and we've got to break something down and fix it. But a lot of times it's just maintenance, and just to make sure that some of these skills that maybe they haven't used in a week or two of play they haven't had, like a backhand maybe or something like that that they haven't had to make in the last week or two, that we go over and go out early and work on that just to keep it sharp. So there's a lot of work that goes on before the regular team, everybody comes out to stretch. A lot of work goes on at 3:30 every afternoon.
And it's funny how the baseball and the baseball gods always seem to find people defensively, right?
it's amazing when you make a double switch or something, you get late in the game, and you have to put a guy out there that maybe hasn't played that particular position in quite some time, that the ball finds you.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like every single time.
So you got Michael Morrison, new first baseman. You'll have D. Gordon at second base this season. He came up as a shortstop, and he moved to second base last year with the Dodgers. Now, you and I have talked about this a lot over the years, but it makes sense to address it again right now. Contrary to what most of us would think, you make a compelling argument that it's actually tougher for a player to move from shortstop to second base than it is to go from second base to shortstop. Can you explain that?
That's exactly my reasoning. My theory, rather. Now, take the arm strength out of the equation. But you got to remember now, if you picture yourself on a baseball field, that everything the shortstop does is in front of him. Moving to every ball, the double play pivot, throwing the ball to second base, to the second baseman for a double play. Everything he does is in front of him. You got great vision of everything in front of you. You got a view of not only your own teammates, but the visiting players, especially coming in on a double play. Now turn that around and take yourself to the other side of the diamond. Probably 70% of what a second baseman does is behind him,
mm-hmm.
covering second on a steal. He's going to get away from the green, fielding a ground ball to his right, away from his target. Going to cover second on the double play is going away from his target. So he's constantly going against everything, with a lot of times his back is to his final destination being first base. So you put that into perspective and take the arm strength out of the equation. That's my theory, is that I think that it's easier for a second baseman to go to shortstop than it is a shortstop to go to second base.
Now, how much of D. Gordon have you seen since he made that move? What have you seen from Gordon since moving from short to second base?
Just a couple of the five or six games that we played them last year, but we've had extensive phone conversations, and he'll be the first one to tell you he kind of winged it last year. And although he had a great year, he knows that there's probably a couple of things he can tweak. I do know there's a couple of plays that I want to talk to him about, that he has a lot of extra motion, a lot of extra movements that he doesn't need. And that's another one of my theories, you know, more movement, more chance of error.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to try to keep things as simple as you can. And a lot of times the guys are just great athletes that can make plays. But then again, if you take away a couple of movements, it makes it easier for them to make great plays.
Speaking of moving and moving around the diamond, that brings us to Martin Prado at third base. One of the more versatile defenders in the game. He's played all over the infield as well as in the outfield at times over the seasons, although third base really is where he's played the most. We've seen a lot of him over the years, especially during his time with the Braves. What does Martin Prado bring defensively at the hot corner?
Well, I've always liked him. When that first time I've ever saw him with the Braves, I saw him with the Braves play third base. They moved him to left field. I've seen him play second. He's a good player. He's one of those guys you just call a good, solid baseball player. He can do a lot of things. He makes contact. He can hit behind a runner. He can play multiple positions. Although I think he's going to be our third baseman, he's just a good baseball player, Jeff. That's just it. I mean, that's a high compliment. The guy can just play the game.
That's the highest compliment a baseball person can pay another baseball person. He's a good baseball player. Baseball people understand what that means.
That means he can do everything.
Yep.
He's efficient on everything. He can do his job. He can move, like I said, he can move a runner. He can play multiple positions. I mean, he never hurts you. He's always in the right spot. He doesn't beat himself. He's a good team player. He cares about his teammates. He gives himself up to make them look good. I mean, he's a baseball player.
Mm-hmm. I used this line a couple of times in this show already over the last couple of months. I at one point remember Chipper Jones saying Martin Prado was the best teammate he had ever had. So you hear praise like that from Chipper Jones, that means a lot. Talking with Perry Hill, can't have you on without asking you about the one returning member of your infield, your shortstop, Danny Echevarria. Etch, a Gold Glove finalist in 2014. How have you seen him grow and develop over the 2 years he's been here?
Oh, he's gotten so much better. You know, once he learns the league and he's learning the players, he's learning to move with the count himself now. He's just more comfortable. He's grasping the language. I mean, just the sky's the limit with this kid. I mean, I've loved him from the moment I laid eyes on him, and he does nothing but get better and better and better. And, I mean, we've got a good one. Talking about a baseball player, this guy's going to be really good.
Mm-hmm.
He's worked with Brett, and he's got bunting in his game now. He's worked with Frankie. He's learned to hit the ball the other way. He's going to be a really good player. I'm glad he's on our team.
Defensively for you, where can he still get better?
Well, I think his double play feeds have got a lot better this year. They were going uphill to the back of the base more consistently than they were in years past. And the other thing is learning to move with the count himself instead of having to be told to go here, go there, go there. I think he's learning the league, he's learning the players, and he's doing that more and more often by himself now. And once he gets that down, and he gets consistent with those double play feeds, he's got the potential, and I think he will someday win a Gold Glove.
Now, he's been out there at shortstop just about every day for the last two seasons, but he started at short next to nine different second basemen as a Marlin. Seven different players started at least once at second base last season. Now you've got Dee Gordon here, and the hope is those two can play next to each other for the foreseeable future. What goes into developing a good shortstop-second baseman relationship?
Well, I think you try to get as many reps as you can during spring training, and you talk about the double play feeds, where do you like it, the underhand feed, the backhand toss, just get accustomed to what the other guy can do and how good at that skill is he. And it's just repetition. You know, in the system that we use, we have a formula based on when you underhand it and when you throw it. And based on that, it's easier for two people who haven't played together. It's going to happen a lot quicker based on our system. But there's nothing more valuable than game experience. The more they play together, the better they'll be.
Now, I know as we wrap up a couple more minutes with Perry Hill, we share a frustration when you compare what we see with our eyes every day and what some of the defensive metrics say about Adani Echevarria. Circling back to Etch for a second, is there a way you can explain the disconnect in how Etch is viewed by coaches, by managers, by his teammates, by other players across the league, and how he's viewed by the guys with the calculators and the slide rules?
Well, I'm not smart enough to know about all the metrics and the mathematics, but I do know what opposing managers and coaches have told me. Larry Boa being one of them, saying he's one of the top three shortstops in the National League. That's good enough for me. I've had Don Mattingly tell me the same thing. I mean, I can just give you a whole list of baseball people who marvel how good this guy is and the number of runs that he saves. And I'm not smart enough to figure out all the metrics. I see them and people present them to me, and I understand that, you know, there's value to that. But on the other hand, I've had good baseball people tell me that Hetch is one of the top three shortstops in the National League, period.
We watch him every night. We see it on a nightly basis. Before I let you run, I tweeted out that you were going to be on the show tonight, and I got a reply from a listener who said he sees your stuff on Twitter all the time, and he asked if on behalf of him and fans everywhere, I can ask you to explain one of the hashtags that you always use on Twitter. It's a big part of your infield teaching method. Can you tell us in a couple of minutes here about the six Fs?
The six Fs.
Might need more than a couple of minutes.
The six Fs is a teaching tool that I came up with more years ago than I'm willing to admit. And it's the basic fundamentals of fielding a ground ball. And I try to come up with something that would be simple and that you could teach to an eight-year-old, but yet you could teach it to a major leaguer. And the six Fs are feet, field, funnel, footwork, fire, follow. And to wrap all that up real quickly is feet, you have to be in a good ready position when the ball's in the hitting zone. You have to be moving, so when the ball's hit, you're already on the move, like kind of like a relay race runner. You're already on the move when you get the baton. That enables you to have a quick first step and get to the ball. The second F is field. We always stress to getting a wide base. You want to be able to see your ball and your glove at the same time. You know, yes, a good hitter sees the ball and the bat at the same time. Well, if you want to be a good, consistent infielder, your feet have to be so wide apart that you can get your glove out front automatically where you can see the ball and the glove at the same time. The funnel is after the ball's in your glove, you get it to the middle of your body, preferably around your chest area. This is where everything in sports happens. When you throw anything, it comes from the middle of your body. A boxer throws a punch. A quarterback has the ball there before he takes it back to pass. A basketball chest pass. I can go on and on and on. but we funnel to get the ball to the perfect throwing position. Footwork is now, as I'm starting to funnel, I have to move toward my target. The footwork formula I use is right to left, left to target. I can go on and on about that one. I know we don't have time. Right when I move my feet, as soon as my left foot hits the ground on my footwork, now my arm is ready to fire the ball. And then when once the ball comes out of my hand, I always want to follow my throw. Take two or three steps at the end of when the ball comes out of my hand to make sure that my head goes toward my target and my arm goes all the way through, that it doesn't recoil back. In a nutshell, that's a success.
And when it's all done right, it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
It certainly is. It works.
For young players, for high schoolers, for collegians, for big leaguers, and their fathers maybe who are out there listening right now, you've got a website, right, with a lot of this information, with videos and things that you offer?
Everything I teach is on the website. It's myinfieldcoach.com.
Folks ought to check
and
it out.
Everything I teach is on that.
Bone, thank you so much for taking some time with us tonight.
All right, Jeff, I appreciate it. My beautiful wife, Olivia, and my two kids are out there somewhere listening. Can I say hello to Olivia?
Say hello.
Alexis and PJ?
Say hello.
Okay. Hello, guys.
All right.
We're out there somewhere.
We'll see you on the Boneyard. We'll see you at the Boneyard.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
All right.
That's Perry
thank
Hill,
you.
Marlins okay. first base coach and infield instructor extraordinaire. Some very good insight into some of the new faces joining this team in 2015. Some good insight into playing defense the big league way, the Perry Hill way. Look at the Gold Glovers he's worked with over the years, the Mike Lowells, the Luis Castillos, the Alex Gonzalez's, and who knows, hopefully before too long, Adani Echevarria is going to add his name to that list as well. Who knows, D. Gordon and others could moving forward here for the Marlins in 2015 and beyond too. We'll see. So we've talked some defense. When we come back, going to talk some pitching. Tom Kohler, big right-hander, big part of this Marlins rotation. He'll join me next as we continue with more Marlins Hot Stove right after this.
Baseball's hot stove season is here. The Marlins' Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Now the count 2-2 to Satin. Kohler fires. Satin swings and misses. He struck him out. Back-to-back strikeouts to end the top of the eighth. Tom Kohler stranding the Mets go-ahead man at second base as he's through eight innings now on 95 pitches.
Here's the 1-2 to Wright. Over strike three. How about that? David Wright, for the third time tonight, has struck out, and that's nine strikeouts for Tom Kohler. It's a new career high, and it strands two Met runners here in the fifth inning.
Last the seventh in a 3-3 game. Kohler about to throw pitch number 101. And a swing and a miss by LeMahieu. He struck him out. If Tom Kohler's night is over, he ends it with a flourish. A couple of strikeouts in the 1-2-3 seventh. Kohler has set down 11 of the last 12 batters he faced in the ballgame. That was some of the best of Tom Kohler from 2014 when the right-hander made 32 starts, worked 191 in a third innings, and won 10 games for the Marlins. He and Nathan Eovaldi, the only two pitchers to make every start for the Marlins a season ago. TK joining us now on Marlins Hot Stove. Tom, thanks for taking a few minutes tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me. Those highlights just got me excited for the season to start.
Good stuff. Ready to go. Hey, talking about getting started, I had Steve Cishek on the show last week. He was talking about the crew that's been working out together up in Jupiter this winter, and he was singing your praises. He said, Tom Kohler is an absolute beast. How's the offseason work been going for you?
You know, it's good. It felt like the season ended with a bitter taste in our mouths, and, you know, I think a lot of us realized how close we were as a team, and now we got some new additions, and I think that's just made the guys who were here last year want to work a little bit harder, be a little bit hungrier to hopefully be one of those teams playing deep into October.
Now, I mentioned on a personal level, you're coming off a season in which you took the ball every 5 days. You went wire to wire. You made all 32 starts. I think that both physically and mentally, it's got to mean a lot to clear that hurdle for the first time in your career. How big of an accomplishment did you feel like that was?
Well, you know, the main goal coming, you know, into any season is to remain healthy and, you know, just know that you're going to give the team everything you got every 5 days. And I think it's, you know, it makes the job of a pitching coach and a manager a lot easier when you know that that guy's going to be there for you every fifth day and, you know, give you some quality innings. So for me to just go out there and take the ball, you know, whenever my day lined up at the end of the year, when I looked back at it, that was the thing I was most proud of.
And how did you feel physically when it was all over after almost 200 big league innings?
You know what? I'll tell you what. I wasn't as tired as I thought I would be, considering that it was about a 20 to 30 inning increase from something that I've done in the past. But, I felt like I could have kept going. I felt like I had about 30 or 40 innings left in the tank. And, you know, looking at the playoffs and what the guys who were just in the playoffs did, that's what you need to do if your team's going to go deep into the season. You got to have those 30 or 40 innings left in you.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that Steve Cishek said last week is that he doesn't normally start his offseason throwing program until around Christmas. But he said even after almost 200 innings, you couldn't wait. You got started in November, he thought.
I started, I think it was December 1st. I usually start the first Monday of December. And, you know, me and Steve got to get ready for different situations. He's getting ready to fire, hopefully, 9 pitches with 3 strikeouts in the 9th inning. I'm trying to throw 9 innings myself. So when we get to spring training, I'm throwing 3 innings in that first game. He's throwing it out. So I got to make sure my arm's ready to go.
Mm-hmm. We should also mention there aren't many big league pitchers who can occasionally turn to their wife when they need a throwing partner. But you're happily in that minority.
Yeah, it's a real nice luxury to have, you know, and you can't get somebody, or it's a holiday like Christmas. We went up to a park and played long toss, and I don't have to hold back, which is nice. She doesn't allow me to throw any breaking pitches because we tried that once and it didn't work out too well, so and we just stick to throwing fastballs.
And for those who don't know, Tom's wife Ashley played college softball at Stony Brook, and we've seen her dazzle in the Marlins Rays Wives game the past few years, although she wasn't able to play last year. She was on the maternity list, I guess. She was pregnant in 2014.
Yeah,
so
she was on the baby DL.
But she'll be back this year, right?
He's looking forward to it. I caught her the other day sitting in the garage taking some dry swings. So I think she's really, really looking forward to it.
Good. Now, you first came up to the big leagues in September of 2012, parts of 3 seasons in the majors for you now, essentially 2 full seasons. What have you learned as a big leaguer, and how do you think you've grown as a pitcher over the last couple of years?
Well, I think the first thing that I had to learn is that I belong there. You know, at the end of the day, it's still the same game, and, you know, you're still going to get guys out the same way you got guys out coming up to the minor leagues. It's just about having confidence that you can do it, and you don't got to change too much. And once I realized that, I felt like I was able to perform at a level that I expect myself to perform. In saying that, I think that, you know, even throughout this year, there was still some growing pains involved, And for me, just being able to make sure when I'm out there, not allowing things to snowball, and just to have those key innings, those key shutdown innings, whether it be early in the game or late in the game, just to stick to the same game plan and not think that just because it's the 7th or the 8th inning, you got to try to trick somebody to get them out. You can still get them out the same way you did, you know, innings 1 through 6.
When you talk about getting that feeling that you belong in the major leagues, was there an outing? Was there a string of outings when it hit you that you're here, you belong here, you're here to stay?
I think for me, it really took until September of 2013. It was, I put together a couple of strings and some really solid starts. And a lot of them, I think, if I remember correctly, were against our own division. And it's when I realized, you know what, I can do this. And not that I didn't have success in some games earlier than that throughout the year, but it was over that stretch that I really, you know, believed that I belong. And then coming into spring training, it wasn't no longer, hey, I'm a guy that's just getting called up. It was, listen, this is my team. I'm going to do everything I can to try to help this team win and advance them as far along as possible.
You talk about having success against teams in the division. Those are teams that you might face 3, 4, 5 times a year. They know you. You know them. So it's not easy when you go out there and you face the Mets for the 4th time or the Phillies for the 5th time in a season.
No, it's not. But, you know, it works both ways. They know what I'm going to throw them, but at the same time, I'm a little bit more familiar of when certain guys are going to try to swing and when you can get away with sneaking a pitch in there because you know they're going to take. So it allows me to be a little bit more aggressive in certain situations.
Are there some guys on this staff or even some pitchers around the league who you talk to a lot who you feel like have been kind of instrumental in helping you develop over the last couple of years?
Not necessarily pitchers, but, you know, I sit next to Jeff Mathis any day that I'm not pitching and he's not catching. And, you know, we talk baseball for 9 straight innings.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really, you know, he sat me down after games and we've had long chats, just whether it's about something he saw, something he thinks that I could do differently, pitch, you know, sequencing or even demeanor, just any little thing. He's always been there to give me that advice. And you know, that's something that he, you know, he's been doing it for a really long time. And Jeff's one of the best defensive catchers in the game, so he knows what he's doing out there. And it was actually funny that my last start of last year, when I went seven innings, I think I gave four runs, but the team came back in the bottom of the seventh for me to get the 10th win. And Jeff comes up to me and he's like, remember what I told you in New York last year? And this was like my second start of the season in 2013. So I'm like, no. He's just like, you just got to outlast the other guys. Sometimes you just got to go out there and outlast the other starter, and you're going to be in a good position to win the ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about 10 wins a season ago. When you look at the new season, are you the kind of guy who likes to map out some goals every year? And if so, what's on the list for 2015?
I'm not a real big fan of personal statistics because, you know, I feel if I go out there and do my job, then everything will kind of fall in line. I like team wins. But if I'm getting the win, if a reliever's coming in and getting the win, as long as we're winning ball games, that means things are going the right way. So the only personal goal I have for myself is to go out there, you know, do my best to stay healthy, throw as many innings as possible, and you know, just try to keep the team in the game.
From a team standpoint, then, what's it been like to see how aggressive this organization has been this winter, trying to take that next step, get this ball club into October?
Man, you know, it was quiet for those first 2 days of the winter meetings, and then I was at the gym, and I looked at my phone, and it was all of a sudden I got like five new teammates. It was crazy. But it's exciting because, you know, we knew when Stanton signed that big contract that they weren't just going to be happy with the team we were putting on the field, because at that time, it was great they signed Stanton to a big deal, but we still had the same exact team. So to see them go out there and, you know, sign Michael Morris and trade for D. Gordon, bring a guy like Latos in, it shows that they're really committed to winning, and not just winning in the future, but winning right now. And as a player, you know, I can't imagine anybody not being excited about that. You know, it's no longer, well, we're just going to piece this season together. We're going for it, and we're going to do the best we can with the guys we got in that clubhouse.
Before we let Tom Kohler go, got to ask you, who you have in the game tonight?
I'm just going to go with Oregon because I like their colors. I think truthfully, they got so many color combinations. They got the best-looking uniforms. So I'm going to go with that. I'm not really a big college football guy coming from the Northeast. We watch the pro sports.
Hey, who won the big fantasy football league? There was a lot of stuff going back and forth on Twitter, I know, when playoff time rolled around. How'd that turn out?
Mathis beat Yelich by less than 1 point.
Wow. All right. And how did Team Kohler do?
Finished in fourth, lost in the third place game. So lost in the quarterfinals and then had a chance to come in third and got out-dueled by Ed Lucas's squad.
There's always next year, right?
Well, if there's a league, I'll be in it.
Very good. Hey, TK, enjoy the game tonight. Thank you for spending some time with us.
All right, sounds good. Thanks for having me.
That is Tom Kohler, the Marlins right-hander. Had a real nice year for this team last year. I think in a very quiet way, went out, took the ball every 5 days, made every single start, gave the Marlins a chance to win every fifth day, wound up with 10 wins of his own, fell just shy of 200 innings in his first full season as a Major League starting pitcher. Remember back in 2013, he spent a little bit of time in the bullpen as well. But whether it's the number four spot, the number five spot, Tom Kohler is going to be an important part of this Marlins rotation again in 2015. And it was good to catch up with him a little bit here tonight. Going to take a break. Got a lot more to get to over the course of the next hour 15 we have with you tonight. Later in the show, going to talk about the New York Mets a little bit with Josh Lewin, one of their radio play-by-play voices, as we go inside the rest of the National League East over the course of the next several weeks leading up to the start of spring training. Find out what's going on in Mets land these days. An interesting offseason, an interesting year coming up for those Mets. Going to hear from Cliff Floyd, the former Marlin, the current MLB Network analyst, get his thoughts on what the Marlins have done so far this offseason. Going to hear from Dave Van Horn, my broadcast partner, talking with Kyle Seeloff about Pedro Martinez's election to the Baseball Hall of Fame. When we come back, going to talk about the Hall of Fame. The big announcement came last Tuesday. A lot going on in Cooperstown. Going to talk about that coming up. We'll hear from DVH shortly. And later in the show, I want to hear from you as well, talking baseball, Marlins baseball, until 9 o'clock tonight. Stay with us. We're Marlins Hot Stove right after this.
Keep your hand on the hot stove with the Marlins' Glenn Gehvner. 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Well, wrapping up the first of our 2 hours here tonight, Marlins Hot Stove taking you up until 9 o'clock. The Cooperstown class of 2015 was announced Tuesday. The Baseball Writers Association of America elected four players to the Baseball Hall of Fame, its largest class since all the way back in 1955. Three first-timers on the ballot received the requisite 75% of the vote, with Randy Johnson leading the way. Number two on the all-time strikeout list, Johnson, a five-time Cy Young Award winner. He received 97.3% of the vote, the eighth highest plurality all time. He was named on 534 of the 549 ballots cast by veteran baseball writers, all but 15. He had that high 90s fastball, but his biggest weapon was known as Mr. Snappy, that devastating slider. He was as uncomfortable in at bat as there has ever been in the big leagues, especially for left-handed hitters. As the years went on, there weren't many lefties in the lineup when RJ was on the hill. Randy Johnson, a first ballot electee to the Baseball Hall of Fame this past week. The great Pedro Martinez, one of my all-time personal favorites from our time together in Boston. He was elected as well. Pedro received 91.9% of the vote. Pedro, a three-time Cy Young Award winner. He was, as I wrote on my blog last week, every bit as intimidating as Randy Johnson, while also being every bit the artist on the mound that Greg Maddux was. He was never afraid to pitch inside with his blazing fastball, but he also possessed one of the best changeups anyone's ever seen. Great curveball. He pitched with flair and charisma, helped the Red Sox win the 2004 World Series, their first title in 86 years. Over the years, Pedro pitched for the Dodgers, the Expos, the Red Sox, the Mets, and finally the Phillies. Spent a lot of time in Montreal with my partner Dave Van Horn. Dave coming up a little bit later in the show talking about Pedro Martinez and his memories of Pedro back in those early years. Joining Johnson and Martinez, the great brave John Smoltz, making this the first time ever the BBWAA had elected three pitchers to the Hall of Fame in the same year. Like RJ and Pedro, Smoltz elected on the first ballot. He received 82.9% of the vote, was the 1996 NL Cy Young Award winner, and is the only pitcher in history with 200 wins and at least 150 saves. One of the great clutch pitchers of all time, Smoltz went 15-4 in his postseason career. He pitched in October in 14 different seasons and was the only player to be a part of each of the Atlanta Division champions 14 consecutive seasons between 1991 and 2005. He joins his Braves manager, Bobby Cox, and rotation mates Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine in Cooperstown. Those three entered the Hall of Fame last summer. Their teammate Chipper Jones is going to be on his way soon as well. After retiring after the 2012 season, Chipper goes on the ballot in 2018. And also elected last week, Craig Biggio, the one member of the class of 2015 to spend his entire career with one team. For Biggio, 20 seasons as a Houston Astro. Remember, Biggio broke into the big leagues as a catcher before he moved to center field and eventually to second base. The owner of more than 3,000 career hits, nearly 700 doubles, more than 400 stolen bases. Biggio, a seven-time All-Star. He won four Gold Gloves and five Silver Slugger Awards. In his third year on the ballot, Craig Biggio was elected with 82.7% of the vote. So Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, John Smoltz, and Craig Biggio make up your Hall of Fame class of 2015. They'll be inducted July 26th in Cooperstown. As for those who fell short, most notably Mike Piazza, he wound up with 69.9% of the vote, generating some positive momentum that could have him poised for election a year from now. A lot of people, myself included, thought that Tim Raines was a Hall of Famer. Well, he hasn't been elected yet. He received 55% of the vote and has only two more years on the ballot. Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds continued to pay the price for the sins they committed, both receiving half the votes that they would have needed for election. This was their third year on the ballot. They get 10 cracks at it. Alan Trammell, the tremendous Tiger shortstop, received only 25% of the vote. Next year will be his last shot on the base writers' ballot. And I mentioned Mike Piazza is a guy with some momentum who could be in line for election in 2016. Curt Schilling, another name I want to talk about. He's got a much longer road to hoe still than Piazza, but he's up to 39% this year and trending in the right direction. With Maddux and Glavine going in last year and Johnson, Martinez, and Smoltz getting the nod this year, Schilling stands to gain some votes over the next few years, and a lot of analysts feel his day is coming. Doubtful will be in 2016 or even 2017, but Schilling and, to a lesser extent, Mike Messina, both trending up coming out of last week's Hall of Fame election. As for 2016, in addition to the returnees like Piazza, Schilling, and Messina, Tim Raines, and Alan Trammell, a total of 25 first-timers are going to be eligible for consideration. Ken Griffey Jr. would seem to be the one automatic. 630 career home runs. Remember, he hit number 600 in Miami back in 2008. Took Mark Hendrickson deep at the old football stadium. For Griffey, a 907 career OPS, on-base plus slugging, 13 All-Star selections, 10 Gold Glove Awards, 7 Silver Sluggers. Played the game with a smile on his face, and in an era when not everybody else did, he played the game clean. Were it not for a string of injuries, who knows, it could well have been Griffey who broke Hank Aaron's career home run record. If it had to fall, I think many would prefer that it would have been Griffey who would have broken that mark. No looking back, though. Let's get back to looking ahead to the 2016 Hall of Fame ballot. Two of the great closers in baseball history will, like Griffey, also make their Hall of Fame ballot debuts next year. Padres legend Trevor Hoffman, you may recall, he made his big league debut with the expansion Marlins back in 1993. First pitcher ever to reach 600 career saves. Hoffy stands second behind only Mariano Rivera on the all-time saves list. Trevor had a big league record 9 seasons with at least 40 saves. He saved 30 or more games 14 times and was selected 7 all-star teams. And then there's Billy Wagner, another intriguing case. 422 saves. They're 179 behind Hoffman, but the fifth most in history. Among left-handers, only John Franco saved more games than Billy Wagner. Like Hoffman, Wagner was also a 7-time All-Star, and his 11.9 strikeouts per 9 innings are the most ever by a major league pitcher who appeared in at least 700 games. So you've got Griffey, a lock. Hoffman and Wagner both look like Hall of Famers to me. The question will be, do they get there on the first ballot? After those three, others appearing on the ballot for the first time next year include longtime Angels teammates Jim Edmonds and Garrett Anderson, as well as a couple of former Marlins, two very popular players in this franchise's history. Mike Lowell will be on the Hall of Fame ballot for the first time in 2016, as will Luis Castillo. Lowell, the great third baseman, Castillo, second baseman. Hall of Famers, probably not, but Edmonds, Anderson, Lowell, and Castillo among those making the ballot for the first time in 2016. What do you think? Did the baseball writers get it right this year? Who ought to get the nod next year? You can tweet me. You can Facebook me. And later on in the show, I'm going to open up the phone lines for you as well, give you a chance to chime in our second hour of the show. I want to remind you about the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Classic coming up at Crandon Golf at Key Biscayne on Wednesday, February 18th. Foursomes, individual spots, and sponsorship opportunities already available. It's a great day every year. Join Marlins players, coaches, executives, and other celebrities for an exciting day of golf at the luxurious Crandon Golf Course overlooking Biscayne Bay in downtown Miami. You can call 1-877-MARLINS or go to marlins.com/golf. You don't want to miss the Jack McKeon Celebrity Golf Class. Again, the date, Wednesday, February 18th at Crandon Golf and Country Club on Key Biscayne. Got an hour to go with you still here tonight. Coming up in our second hour, going to hear from Dave Van Horn talking about Pedro Martinez, the early years for the great Martinez, who was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame on Tuesday. Going to hear from Cliff Floyd, the former Marlin, the current MLB Network analyst, talking about the Marlins offseason. Going to talk about my proposal, kind of outside-the-box proposal for the Marlins lineup in 2015. I'm also going to talk about the division rival New York Mets with one of their radio voices. Josh Lewin's going to join me live coming up in our second hour tonight as we begin what will be a tour of the NL East over the course of the next several weeks on Marlins Hot Stove, looking into the Mets, the Phillies, the Braves, and the Nationals, what they're all up to here in the winter of 2015. You mentioned Pedro, among those elected to the Hall of Fame this past week. Dave Van Horn, the voice of the Expos, when Pedro really began to make his mark in the big leagues back in the mid-90s. When we come back, Dave's going to share some Pedro memories with Kyle Seeloff. So stick around. Hour number two of Marlins Hot Stove coming up next.
Show with Glenn Geffner is on.
Nice and fires. Morneau swings. Loops one into center field. Out goes Etch. A long way out. He dives and makes the catch to save the night.
940 wins.
How about that for thrills?
Miami Sports.
I'm glad you're with us this Monday night, our second hour. Marlins Hot Stove talking baseball with you as we do every Monday night between 7 and 9. Counting down the days, 39 of them until pitchers and catchers hit the field up in Jupiter. It won't be long now. We were talking in the last segment about Ken Griffey Jr., who goes on the Hall of Fame ballot for the first time in 2016, and I was reminded, I wanted to bring this up. We saw Ken Griffey Jr. at Turner Field back in July. He was out at the ballpark one day to sit down with Giancarlo Stanton, where they recorded an interview and they followed Stanton around for the day. Ken Griffey Jr. Has a new TV show on the MLB Network, and it happened to premiere this past Saturday, and I happened to see the first episode that he did. He shot a series of 4 shows, one with Giancarlo Stanton, one with David Ortiz, one with Andrew McCutchen, and one with Mike Trout. Ken Griffey Jr.'s big sticks, and he's going inside hitting with some of the great hitters in Major League Baseball these days. The Stanton episode was terrific. Some really good insight. Listen to Giancarlo talk about his approach. And I know when we talked about New Year's resolutions for Marlins fans, making resolutions for Marlins players on this show last week as we rang in the new year, one of the things I heard from a few different fans was they want Stanton to resolve to lay off that breaking ball down and away that he chases all too often. And it's funny, when he and Ken Griffey Jr. were watching video of a Stanton at bat on this show, he took one of those swings where he got himself out chasing a breaking ball down and away out of the zone, and Griffey got on him for that. And Ken Griffey Jr. actually said it was a big thing for his dad. His dad used to tell a young Ken Griffey Jr., look, there's nothing you can do with that pitch. You've got no power, can't hit that ball with authority. You got to lay off that pitch. And Griffey, over the course of the years, became capable of laying off that pitch. Hopefully Giancarlo will as well. But it's really worth your while. Check your DVR. Look for Ken Griffey Jr.'s big sticks. The Stanton episode was terrific. I saw the David Ortiz episode as well. Haven't seen McCutchen or Trout yet, but an interesting program. Hope you'll check it out. Some very good insight into the mind and the bat of Giancarlo Stanton. Talking about Griffey in the Hall of Fame next year, we mentioned Pedro Martinez, part of that group going into the Hall of Fame this year. When Pedro got to the big leagues, initially, remember, he was Los Angeles Dodger. And Tommy Lasorda and others in L.A. thought he was just too small to hold up over the course of the long season as a starting pitcher. They saw him as a relief pitcher, and they eventually traded him to the Montreal Expos for second baseman Delino DeShields. Dodgers thought they got the better of the deal, getting an everyday second baseman in a deal for a relief pitcher. Well, Pedro certainly turned out to be a whole lot more than a relief pitcher in the big leagues. And my partner Dave Van Horn had a ringside seat to watch Pedro as he really burst onto the scene in the big leagues in those seasons in Montreal. Earlier this week, after Pedro was elected to the Hall of Fame, our own Kyle Seeloff talked with Dave, and here's that conversation.
Dave, great to have you on. We hope you and the family have had a happy and healthy offseason. Let's chat about a guy you had the pleasure of watching in Montreal, one of the newest four members of the Hall of Fame class of 2015, Pedro Martinez. And we'll start by going all the way back to November 19th of 1993, when the Expos traded Delino DeShields to the Dodgers for a 22-year-old kid who would be Pedro. What do you remember from that trade, and what was the initial feeling after it?
Well, I remember from a personal standpoint in that November trade, I was sorry to see Delino DeShields go. I thought he was, a rising star in the league and a pretty exciting player. And I was kind of sorry to see him go. And I really didn't know what we were getting in Pedro Martinez. I knew all about Ramon Martinez, but his older brother. But I didn't know that much about Pedro. And, of course, we found out later that the reason the Dodgers made him available was that the consensus among the Dodger people, including Tommy Lasorda, was that Pedro just wasn't strong enough to be a starting pitcher. They thought they were giving up a bullpen arm to get an everyday player in Delino DeShields. And I remember thinking all that through in that winter of 93 into 1994 before that season started.
Pedro, and you just alluded to it with Tommy Lasorda, and they didn't know if Pedro was going to be a starting pitcher. Well, he spent the 2 years in L.A., and he had never started, but he was given that chance to start in 1994 in Montreal. Do you recall roughly when was it that Pedro kind of took the scene by storm and really started to open some eyes? Was it that season or the ones that followed?
Well, in 94, he certainly opened some eyes, as did the Expos. They had a wonderful year in 94. Unfortunately, it ended on a very sour note because the strike came about and the cancellation of the season and postseason and everything. But the Expos had the best record in baseball at the time of that strike in 94. Pedro was one of the reasons why. Going back to spring training that year, it was Felipe Alou who said that Pedro was going to be a starting pitcher. Felipe was a big believer in Pedro's strength and his arm and his ability. And there was no question in Felipe Alou's mind, although there were some questions in other baseball people's mind, whether or not Pedro would be a good starting pitcher. There was never a question in Felipe. And Felipe was not only a father figure to Pedro. Here he was his manager, and in effect, Felipe Alou was also Pedro's pitching coach. He worked hard to help Pedro command the strike zone. And we saw glimpses of that in 1994. And if memory serves me correctly, Pedro won 11 games during that strike-shortened season, but really came into his own as a dominant pitcher in the next couple of years. And, of course, his final year in Montreal, 1997, was the Cy Young year. So all of the work that Pedro put in under the guidance of Felipe Alou paid off, and the result was a Cy Young award for Pedro in 1997.
It's been great since Tuesday to hear all the personal stories of guys reminiscing of Pedro and when they met Pedro. On a more personal level, do you remember your first encounter, your first meeting with Pedro?
Well, Pedro was always very outgoing and willing to talk. He was great fun to be around. And as much hard work as he turned in, he was a delight in the clubhouse and in the dugout on days that he wasn't pitching. Had a great sense of humor, and he had a great team spirit about him, too. When you would go into the Expos clubhouse after a Montreal win that season, Pedro, whether he had pitched in that game or whether he was just in between starts, was one of the cheerleaders in the clubhouse. He just had a great time. He got along with every single teammate, all other 24 players, enjoyed Pedro and laughed at Pedro. He was an absolute delight, and he was the life of the party after wins in that clubhouse.
I'll leave this question a little vague because everyone kind of has a different take on it, but Pedro was great. In your opinion, what made him so special?
Well, obviously that arm, and the fact that Pedro had, he wasn't that big a guy in stature, but he had long, long fingers and big hands. And the ball just did something special when it came out of Pedro's hands, and we could see that from the very beginning, even before he harnessed all that power. I think the one thing that was misunderstood in the early years about Pedro, he got the reputation as being a headhunter, mainly because he couldn't control that fastball, and he was absolutely fearless on pitching up and in to both left-hand and right-hand batters. But that ball would get away from Pedro. And I thought that while Felipe stayed the course with him, they did work on technical things to improve his command of that fastball. And but that goes right back to the very beginning with Pedro, an unfair characterization, I think, at that time. Now, that having been said, I don't ever have I ever considered Pedro a headhunter, but would he establish inside? Absolutely. And did he enjoy putting fear in the hearts of hitters? Absolutely. All good pitchers do.
Chatting with the voice of the Marlins, Dave Van Horn on the Marlins Hot Stove Show tonight. And Dave, I started by asking you what it was like when Pedro hit the scene in Montreal. But what was it like after that 97 season, one of his best ever, a 190 ERA, you talked about it, 31 starts, 13 complete games, his first of three Cy Young awards when he was sent to Boston for Carl Pavano and Tony Armas, who was the player to be named later in that deal?
Well, it was heartbreaking. We had been through so much in Montreal in seeing good players come and go, and certainly here this was not just a good player. This was a player headed for greatness in the game, one of the game's dominant right-handers, and after his first Cy Young Award, the Expos didn't even get a chance to make the presentations to him down on the field because, of course, that happened after the season, and after that season he was gone. It was a big disappointment, but it sort of went with the territory in Montreal at that time. One thing I wanted to say about Pedro, too, he really took to the city of Montreal. Obviously, the Expos fans took to Pedro. Pedro took to the city. He ingratiated himself to everybody. He was recognized, of course, everywhere. He absolutely loved the city and the people of Montreal and the Montreal fans. It's why he still feels very close to the baseball fans and to the city of Montreal even to this day.
Dave, last question before I let you go. Over the course of his four seasons in Montreal, what's one of the more funny Pedro Martinez stories that comes to your mind?
Well, obviously, the work on controlling the fastball. None of the Expos hitters, not even the coaches, wanted to stand in the batter's box down in the bullpen when Felipe would be down there working with Pedro on his pitching. Nobody wanted to stand in against Pedro. So the club went out and bought from one of the sporting goods companies one of those baseball mannequins in a hitting position holding a bat. It was a hard plastic material, and they stood that into that area, and that's what Pedro pitched to. Before they got their hands on that sporting goods product, one of the minority owners of the Expos was in the clothing business. He lent a mannequin, a store mannequin, to the ball club for Pedro to pitch to, and Pedro absolutely destroyed the mannequin in his very first outing. He took its head off, the torso, arms, legs, everything went. They brought him another one the next day. He destroyed that, and that was the end of the store mannequins, and they went out and got the baseball figure, which did not get destroyed, but it sure had some marks on it left by Pedro.
Well, it was certainly a career for Pedro Martinez. You had the pleasure of watching for quite some time. Dave, thanks so much for taking a few minutes. Happy New Year to you and the family. We'll see you at Roger Dean Stadium soon to kick off spring training.
Same to everybody. I'm as excited about the 2015 edition of this ball club as everyone else, and I can't wait to get spring training started.
Good stuff from Kyle Seeloff. Always fun to listen to Dave Van Horn tell stories, no matter what time of the year it is. Maybe especially fun this time of year with everybody yearning to get back onto the field and play some baseball again. My personal favorite Pedro Martinez story happened in 2003, my first year with the Red Sox. It happened in the Red Sox clubhouse. I needed to schedule an extended sit-down interview with Pedro in the days ahead, and my strategy was, grab him pregame, you know, at his locker, and try to set something up for the day after he next pitches. Make it the easiest day for him on his schedule. Do it the day after he pitches. So I approached Pedro, and I told him what I wanted to do. He said, yeah, no problem. When do you want to do it? And I said, well, you throw Thursday night, right? And he just stared at me. And it looked like I really angered him. He said, no. And I thought about it. My mind was racing. I knew he had last pitched on Saturday. There were no days off coming up on the schedule, so I was sure that the next time he took the mound was going to be Thursday night. I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure you throw Thursday against the Orioles. And then he finally decided he was going to let me off the hook easy, but not without teaching me a little bit of a lesson. And really, it kind of reflects how seriously he approached his craft, the passion he had for the game, and also the significance of words to Pedro Martinez. And Dave referenced this in his conversation with Kyle. He said to me, no, I don't throw on Thursday. I pitch on Thursday. That was the great Pedro Martinez. He taught me a lesson that afternoon at Fenway Park, and now he's on his way to the Baseball Hall of Fame. When we come back, going to talk about the National League East Division rival New York Mets with one of their radio voices. Josh Lewin joins me next. More Marlins Hot Stove right after this on 940 Wins.
Marlins Baseball Hot Stove Talk with Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Well, in the week's ahead of Marlins Hot Stove, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about the rest of the National League East with guests who cover the Marlins division rivals on a daily basis. Tonight, we turn our attention to the New York Mets, who a season ago made some really nice strides on the way to a 79-83 finish, left them tied with the Braves for second in the National League East, 17 games behind the division champion Nationals, 2 games up on the Marlins. This is a year in which the Marlins think they have a shot to take that next step, get back to the playoffs for the first time in a while. And I think it's safe to say they feel the exact same way at Citi Field. And to talk about those Mets, I'm joined now by one of the radio voices, Josh Lewin. Josh, thanks for a few minutes tonight.
Anytime, Geoff. How you doing?
Doing great. Let's start with expectations. It's been a tough last several years for the Mets. They had the September collapses in 07 and 08, win totals in the 70s every season since. Sandy Alderson asked for a little bit of patience, which is in short supply in New York. How good are the chances this is the year Mets fans see their patience rewarded?
Well, a lot of it's going to have to do with how good you guys get, and I think there is a general sense that the Marlins are much improved. The Nationals, you know, I mean, obviously they're still the team you got to beat, but there just seems to be a kind of a crack in the foundation. I don't know how you feel about it, but whether it's Jason Worth injury or just the whole vibe there just doesn't seem quite correct. So I think the division is there, and frankly, I think the Marlins have done more than the Mets have to try to get themselves ready for that next step for right now. You know, Michael Kadire was a real nice signing. He'll certainly help. Matt Harvey coming back is the equivalent of Jose coming back for you guys. So, it's such a weird division to try to pick, especially on January, whatever this is. But you know, it's interesting to think that the Mets could be one of those teams. You're right, that just kind of catches that wave. You know, if they're in it and close at the trade deadline, you know, I have to imagine finally the year they've got the payroll flexibility to go get that one missing piece, whatever that missing piece may end up being. But, you know, to me, you throw Washington, Miami, and the Mets in a tumbler. I think Atlanta and Philly are definitely a distant fourth and fifth in the division this year.
You've given me a lot to jump off of with that answer. I want to start with Matt Harvey, who you mentioned. We've seen the best of Zach Wheeler. We have seen more than enough of Jacob deGrom in 1 year in the big leagues. We know what you have with those two. You've got Jonathan Neese, Dylan G, Bartolo Colon. Somebody could be traded between now and the start of spring training. But you've got Matt Harvey coming back from Tommy John surgery. He had his surgery in October of 2013, so he's had a little bit of extra time. What's the plan for Harvey this season? Is there a Steven Strasburg scenario, or what have the Mets said to this point about how they're going to handle Harvey?
Yeah, I think they'll be a little bit more liberal than the Nationals were. I mean, Harvey is such a ridiculous competitor, I mean, to his own detriment sometimes. I mean, it's going to be tough to tell him, hey, you only have 80 pitches, 90 pitches, 100 pitches, and you're done. I mean, I think he'd, you know, pinch Terry Collins' head off if he was pitching well and Terry came out to make a move. But they do want to manage him. You know, they want to make sure that everything is right. So they'll kind of ease him back in. You know, I mean, who knows? It might be one of those things where he's not even really back in the rotation full time, you know, right away. Who knows how that's going to go. But you're right. When you've got depth, you can kind of afford to play with that a little bit. DeGrom sure seems like the real deal. You know, the initial thing that you always go to as well, you know, the league has seen him now. They'll catch up to him. But like you suggested, you know, you guys saw him 3-4 times, and you didn't catch up to him third or fourth time, right? You know, so I really think there's some staying power there. Wheeler's a bit of a wild card. You know, Neese, G. I think one of those two guys might be the guy that gets dealt. They've got Noah Syndergaard coming up, so the, you know, the pitching is great. I think it's a top five rotation in the majors right now. And Harvey needs to be a big part of that.
Let's talk offense then. You mentioned the Kadir addition. At the start of the winter, they looked like they needed an outfield bat. They got that quickly. They struck early on Kadir. And the Mets need a shortstop. At the moment, they've still got Wilmer Flores, and they've still got Ruben Tejada. There was some talk that maybe Ben Zobrist had been an option, maybe Ian Desmond. There was the Troy Tulowitzki talk. Are they ready to go into the season with Flores and Tejada?
Yeah, it sure looks that way. I mean, something might come up that surprising. Desmond sure would have been surprising had they been able to pull that off. There's a lot of Met fans that are kind of going, really? You guys had a chance to steal Desmond and you didn't do it? But you know, Desmond's only under control for 1 year. And, you know, if it's going to cost you Noah Syndergaard and another really good prospect just to rent the shortstop for a year, I understand why they didn't necessarily want to do that. But, yeah, at some point they're going to need better than what Tejada's been given in the last 2 years. Flores has a bat that I think is a 17-homer, 68 RBI bat, and that's great, but the question is about his glove. So, you know, it's funny. You guys have a Danny, you know, and you're very comfortable with the glove. You just wonder if he'll ever hit. And the Mets have the exact opposite problem with Flores.
Let's look at a couple other big bats in that lineup for the Mets. Lucas Duda, looks like they chose properly when they opted for Duda over Ike Davis last year. He had the big year, the 30-homer season. And Travis d'Arnaud finally took off in the second half behind the plate last year after a slow start. What's the confidence level both of them pick up where they left off last year?
I think very high. D'Arnaud, you're right, it took a while. It took a demotion, actually, to AAA to finally kind of get his mind right. He had a very strong second half. And the Davis trade to make room for Duda seemed backwards to a lot of Mets fans in May. But, you know, Ike Davis is now scrapping for a job, and Duda ended up actually third in the National League in home runs, of all things. So I think Duda, who's a very quiet guy, is confident that he can do this again, and I think d'Arnaud is as well.
Talking to Mets radio voice Josh Lewin. It's going to be fun, and I think these two teams, the Marlins and the Mets, have a lot in common heading into this season. It's going to be interesting to watch their two journeys over the course of 162.
No question. To me, those are the two most interesting teams in the division because they're mixing what's kind of on the way up with what's already there. They've got fan bases that are properly skeptical, and you know, they're just kind of waiting for that ignition switch to hit. And, you know, if both teams hit the switch, that's great. It'll make for a lot of fun, a nice three-team race. If just one of our two teams hits that switch, it'll make for a fun year.
Josh Lewin, thanks for the time.
Anytime, buddy. See you soon.
We'll see you in Port St. Lucie. That is Josh Lewin, who teams with Howie Rose on the New York Mets radio broadcast. This Mets ball club, a very interesting team. And really, you look at this National League East, and over the course of the next several weeks, we're going to talk at length about the Braves, the Phillies, the Nationals as well. We're starting with the Mets tonight because they have so many similarities to the Marlins in that they've been building it up. They've been bringing some younger players along, taking some lumps, getting better at the big league level. And now they feel as though this is the year. This is the time to strike. And as Josh pointed out, whereas the Marlins have been incredibly aggressive this offseason in filling the holes that they had, there's some in New York wondering, well, when are the Mets going to do everything that they need to do in filling all of the holes that they had? And they didn't have many holes. We mentioned the outfield and shortstop being the two big positions where they could look to improve themselves. They brought Michael Kadire in coming off an injury-plagued season in Colorado this past year. But when Kadire's healthy, still a very productive player. But they still need a shortstop. And it really is hard to believe that they can go into the year with Wilmer Flores or Ruben Tejada. The shortstop position has been a bit of a black hole for the Mets ever since they let Jose Reyes walk via free agency after the 2011 season when he signed with Miami, came here in 2012. But this is an interesting team. Again, we've seen the best of Zach Wheeler on the mound. We've seen the best of Jacob deGrom on the mound. They get Matt Harvey back. And one of the really interesting storylines in the league this year, I think, will be how do the Matt Harveys and the Jose Fernandezes come back from Tommy John surgery? How big of an impact will they make in the race? Because in Harvey and Fernandez, you're talking about two absolutely elite emerging aces. Before that, Tommy John surgery struck them both in their first full big league season. And Harvey's got the advantage of having had his surgery, what, about 7 months earlier, in October of 2013, as opposed to May of 2014 when Jose had his. So Harvey's ready to go this spring, ready to go come opening day. How will he hold up over the full season? How much of a difference will he make for the Mets? It's a good rotation with Bartolo Colon, with Dylan G, with Jonathan Neese also. Somebody most likely to go via trade in the weeks ahead, although they could hang on to some extra depth, you never know. But it's an interesting team. They brought Curtis Granderson, hit some home runs last year, struck out a lot, hit for low average. They will boost their offensive production in the outfield with Michael Kadire. They had the good year out of Lucas Duda last year, a good second half from Travis d'Arnaud behind the plate. You know what you have at second base in Daniel Murphy, who has always been a good bat, hits around 300, a lot of doubles, he'll steal some bases, doesn't have a lot of power, not a great defensive player, but he's a good top-of-the-order type hitter. And then you've got the captain, David Wright, who's missed significant time due to injury in three of the last four seasons for the Mets. When he's healthy, still a productive hitter, still only 32 years old, but it's been tough keeping David Wright healthy and on the field in three of the last 4 years for the Mets. So it's a very interesting team, and I really do think you're going to be talking about the Mets and the Marlins in the same breath a lot over the course of 2015. Two very similar teams, kind of at the same place in their development heading into the year, where they like to think they both have a chance to make a run at the Washington Nationals. Last year, the Mets finished 17 games back. The Marlins finished 19 games behind Washington. So both teams have huge hills to climb heading into 2016. No question about that. But both feel as though they can certainly, if nothing else, work their way into wildcard contention. And who knows? Josh talked about some of the cracks in the Nationals' foundation. Maybe make a run at that Washington team if they can catch some breaks along the way. But it'll be fun to watch the Marlins and the Mets. They'll go at it 19 times this year. It always seems like it's an exciting season series, always a lot of close games. The Mets have handled the Marlins pretty well. When you look at the win-loss record in the last three or four seasons after the Marlins really had the upper hand for several years before that. But every time these two teams get together, it seems like it's a nail-biter right down to the final pitch. I had that 21-inning game at Citi Field on a Saturday afternoon 2 seasons ago. Always fun when it's the Marlins and the Mets, and it should be extra fun with both teams poised to make a big move in the National League East, we think, heading into 2015. So again, some good stuff from Josh Lewin, one of the Mets radio voices. When we come back, a lot more to get to in our final half hour of the show. Going to hear from Cliff Floyd on the improvements the Marlins have made this winter, and going to run you through my proposal for the Marlins' 2015 batting order. You're going to want to hear this. Stick around. We'll get to some of your phone calls as well in our final half hour. 30 more minutes of Marlins Hot Stove on 940 Wins.
Baseball's burning questions all winter long. Winter long. Fire up the stove with the Marlins' Glenn Geffner on 940 Wins.
Right around third, Ozuna the throw to the plate, and Wright is out at the plate. Ozuna throws out the tying man for the second out of the eighth.
Miami Sports.
Oh, so much of the first half hour of our show tonight talking pitching and defense with Tom Kohler and Marlins infield instructor Perry Hill. And I want to spend some time coming up talking offense and specifically how Mike Redmond could choose to put his batting order together in 2015. But before we go a little bit deeper there, if you listen to our broadcast throughout the season, you know Kyle Seeloff. Kyle back for a third season as host of our Marlins On Deck pregame show in 2015. He recently talked with former Marlin and current MLB Network analyst Cliff Floyd and asked him for his thoughts on the improvement the Marlins have made to their roster over the course of this winter.
When you look at what these guys have been able to do this all season, for me, it's tremendous when you talk about building a team. And it's a difference because sometimes you build teams that are different in areas of, when you say power, when you say one-dimensional. Well, this team is starting to be all, you know, every dimension you can possibly be. And that's important. When you want to be consistent, that's important when you look at the window of opportunity in NL East. And I think it's well-rounded now when you look at this ball club. I think, you know, Mike Redmond has definitely some different options. I see they're trying to upgrade the bench. But when you bring in Mike Morris, solidify the middle of the order behind Giancarlo, you bring in a Martin Prado, you bring in a D. Gordon, now you have the speed. Now you can utilize and sort of be that team that can score runs in the first inning to allow your young pitching staff to still continue to grow. And I'm not talking about Hosey. I'm talking about the other cast that's in the rotation. What they basically get is some confidence in the first couple innings because they have a run or two on the board early. They don't have to fight and go, you know what, I got to put zeros up, you know, for 5 innings and hopefully we can score a run before I get out of here. Those things change drastically when you talk the improvement of your rotation to be able to now work on just one area of your team. Let's work on this bullpen and get to Shishak. At the end, you still have to worry about the seventh and eighth innings, and those are things that you don't have many other issues. You can look around the team now and go, we're going to catch the ball, and we're going to put the ball in play. We have speed. We have some power in the middle. And now let's make sure that when we have the lead in the seventh and eighth, that we get the Shishak with the lead and we don't give it away. And those are things that you can figure out. And Dan Jennings will definitely do that. You know, I have all the confidence in him to do that. But at the end of the day, you know, you don't have all areas to worry about. And that's just a great, I would think, and I'm not in their shoes, but I would think that's a great feeling to have, you know, when you have a month left before pitching the catcher's report.
That was Cliff Floyd on the Marlins winter. Some very good stuff. Now, forgetting the additions to the pitching staff for the purposes of this discussion, they have added D. Gordon, Martin Prado, Michael Morris to a lineup that already included arguably the best outfield in the league, Giancarlo Stanton, Marcell Ozuna, and Christian Yelich. So the question becomes, how does Mike Redmond construct a lineup that plays to the strengths of each of these players and maximizes the Marlins' offensive efficiency? I asked Red about his plans for lineup on the show last week, and he acknowledged it's really still a work in progress. He's going to look at some things over the course of this spring. But I'm an impatient guy, so I came up with a proposal of my own, and I posted it along with a very detailed rationale on my blog over the week. And I want to run through some of my thoughts a little bit and get your feedback and your suggestions. You can tweet me or Facebook me, or if you have some time at the end of the show tonight, call us up here. Here's the deal. Right after the Marlins signed Michael Morris, it looked like there was one most logical way to construct a lineup. Top to bottom, you probably would have gone D. Gordon leading off, Christian Yelich in the two-hole, Giancarlo batting third. That's easy. Morris hits cleanup. Casey McGee was still here then, remember, hitting fifth. Batted cleanup last year. Marcell Ozuna hits sixth. Jared Saltalamacchia seventh. And Danny Echevarria in the eight-hole. And then the pitcher bats ninth. But then things change when the Marlins acquired Martin Prado from the Yankees to play third base, and they traded McGee to the Giants. You could just slot Prado right into the five hole where McGee would have hit. But while Prado's offensive versatility means he could really slot in just about anywhere in the lineup. You could hit him fourth, you could hit him fifth or sixth, you could lead him off. He's enjoyed most of his career success hitting second, and he really profiles as a prototypical number two hitter. So how about this proposal? Christian Yelich leads off, as he did last year. Martin Prado bats second, Stanton third, Morse batting cleanup. This is my proposal. Marcell Ozuna now hitting fifth, Jared Saltalamacchia behind the plate hitting sixth for Miami. Adani Echevarria bats seventh. You may say, wait a minute, where's D. Gordon? I thought he was going to lead off. I've got the pitcher hitting eighth, and D. Gordon, the speedy second baseman, hitting ninth. Yes, proposing that the Marlins hit the pitcher eighth in 2015 with D. Gordon batting ninth. And here's very quickly my top-to-bottom rationale. Going to go each spot through the lineup. Christian Yelich, terrific as the Marlins' leadoff man in 2014, is a patient hitter, second in the league in pitches seen per plate appearance. He was only 22 in his first full big league season. but he had a great year. He did a good job getting on base. He's got the ability to steal a base. And at this point in his career, still, he's primarily a singles doubles hitter. A lot of people think he's going to develop more power over time, and he could well one day hit third for the Marlins, but he's not that guy quite yet. I really like the job he did leading off in 2014, so I propose leaving Yelich in the leadoff spot for 2015. Prado, your prototypical number two hitter. He'll take a pitch to allow a base runner to steal. He can hit behind a runner to move him up. He's always done a good job getting on base. He's got a 340 lifetime OBP. He's got, at least to this point in their careers, more power than Yelich. Prado's averaged 35 doubles, 12 homers over the last 6 years, so I like him hitting second. Stanton in the three hole, that's where he's been. That's automatic for me. Could you hit him fourth? Sure you could. But conventional wisdom in baseball these days is you bat your best hitter third for a few reasons. First, you're guaranteed to get him to the plate in the first inning of every game, a chance to get on the scoreboard early. Second, and there's a lot of research to back this up, your third hitter bats with more base runners on over the course of 162 games than the cleanup man does. And over the course of the full 162, your number three hitter is going to average about 2.5 more trips to the plate than your number four hitter. Again, getting Stanton up more often and with more base runners makes all the sense in the world to me if you're going to try to maximize the club's offensive output. That's why I like Stanton third, not fourth. Michael Morse would bat fourth in my proposed lineup. May not be your prototypical 35 home run cleanup man, but Morse has had a real nice career over 10 seasons, tremendous power. He's hit as many as 31 home runs in a year, hit 16 in the regular season for the Giants last year, had a huge home run in the postseason. He's got a lifetime 808 OPS, definitely gives pitchers something to think about behind Stanton, so I've got Michael Morse batting cleanup in my proposed lineup. We talked about what he's done in the past. It's worth pointing out, Marlins have gotten very little production at the cleanup spot the last couple of years. In 2014, a major league low, six homers, and just a 726 OPS from the cleanup spot. And in 2013, Logan Morrison and Marcelo Ozuna, a rookie then, spent most of the year, those two, batting cleanup. They had the majority of the teams at bats batting fourth in 2013, and they combined out of the cleanup spot for only four homers over the entire season. So it shows you how little the Marlins have gotten out of the cleanup spot the last couple of years. Michael Moore certainly could be a huge upgrade there. I'm going to go with Marcelo Ozuna in the five spot in my proposed lineup. He's only 24. He had 23 homers, drove in 85 runs last season, hitting mostly in the sixth hole. In all of baseball, only one player, 23 or younger, hit more home runs and drove in more runs than Ozuna last year. That was the AL MVP, Mike Trout. We know Ozuna can still get better, improve plate discipline with more experience, critical for him, but I've got Ozuna hitting fifth in my proposed lineup to start the year. Now, I'll go with the one switch hitter in the lineup, Jared Saltalamacchia, batting sixth. He had a rough first year with the Marlins, and you'd love to see him bounce back and put up numbers along the lines of what he did as a Red Sox back in 2013. If he does, he could move up a spot even if Ozuna were to struggle or in matchups against certain tough right-handers. For Salty, though, the hope is more doubles and fewer Ks in the new year. I've got Saltalamacchia hitting six. Now, this is where I'll deviate from the projected normal bit. I've got Echevarria hitting seventh. Showed a lot of improvement last season. Is there still room for growth for Etch? No doubt. But his OPS was up 99 points from 2013 to 2014. He shortened his swing, took a lot of balls to right field. His bunting game got better working with Brett Butler. He had more line drives, more ground balls, fewer fly balls. I've got Etch hitting seventh in front of the pitcher. This is where the fun begins. I propose the Marlins hit their starting pitcher eighth in 2015. The key here is if an NL team is going to bat the pitcher eighth and a position player ninth, you need the right personnel to make it work. And I think the Marlins have the right personnel. With D. Gordon hitting ninth, you get the second leadoff hitter effect with him and Yelich batting back-to-back once Gordon comes up for the first time in a game. You then have the benefit of three consecutive on-base threats, Gordon, Yelich, and Prado, batting directly in front of your best RBI man, Stanton, without pushing Stanton down to the fourth spot and costing him at-bats over the course of the year. Again, the idea is to get Stanton as many at-bats as possible. That's why hitting third is better than fourth, with as many men on base as possible. That's why having Gordon, Yelich, and Prado back-to-back-to-back in front of Stanton maximizes potential base runners. D. Gordon last year led the major leagues with 64 stolen bases, and I'd argue that you free him up to run even more if he hits out of the number nine spot. If Gordon leads off, no matter who hits second, when D's at first base, you've got Stanton on deck, and you find yourself in that weird spot where you fear the risk of Gordon getting thrown out attempting to steal. You cost yourself a base runner with your very best hitter in the on-deck circle. And I'm going to go a step farther than that even and argue that a stolen base from Gordon is more valuable when he's hitting in front of both Yelich and Prado because they're more likely to single Gordon in from second base, whereas Stanton's propensity to hit doubles and home runs means Gordon often wouldn't even need to steal a base to have a good chance to score with Giancarlo coming up. Now, you take it a step further, Gordon on base ahead of them means more fastballs for Yelich and Prado, even in breaking ball counts, and that leads to more production from two of the bats the Marlins are going to definitely count on this year to lift some of the burden off of Giancarlo's shoulders in 2015. So there very quickly, I rushed through it a little bit, but there are many of the reasons why I think it makes sense, but with some time constraints here, I'm going to leave my part of the discussion as that. Would love for you to chime in. What do you think? When we come back, if you want to jump on the phone lines, now's the time, 866-801-0940. I've given you something to think about. What do you think about the Marlins hitting the pitcher eighth, D. Gordon ninth, and then going Gordon nine, Yelich one, Prado two, Stanton three, Morse four, trying to maximize what they get offensively out of their ball club in 2015? Would love to hear your thoughts. You may think I'm crazy. Call me up and tell me. You may love the idea. If you're in that camp, I especially want you to call us up. 866-801-0940. Your thoughts on the lineup, your thoughts on anything else that may be on your mind in our final moments. Coming up, a little bit more of Marlins Hot Stove on this Monday night on 940 Wins.
Baseball's hot stove season is here. The Marlins' Glenn Geffner is on 940 Wins, Miami Sports.
Well, of course, the last couple of hours, we've heard from Perry Hill. We've heard from Tom Kohler. We've heard from Dave Van Horn, from Josh Lewin, and from Cliff Floyd. I have some time to hear from you if you'd like to jump on the line, 866-801-0940. You got about 10 minutes to go here on this Monday night edition of Marlins Hot Stove, talking Marlins baseball. Up until the top of the hour, I ran through my proposed Marlins lineup for 2015, the proposed batting order, a little bit outside the norm, with D. Gordon batting ninth, the pitcher hitting eighth, trying to maximize offensive efficiency for the Marlins in the new season. I would say the response I got after I wrote the blog on Saturday, and I heard from a lot of people, whether it was on the blog or via Twitter and Facebook, was about 80% positive. There were those who said, I'm just not comfortable with it. It's outside the norm. I don't like change. I don't handle change well. And there were others who, for whatever reason, wanted to do something different or just more conventional. But for the most part, many of the fans I heard from liked the idea. And we'll see how it all plays out. It's something different. A lot of people compared it to what Tony La Russa did. It's not like I came up with this idea all by myself. Tony La Russa, at one time, late in his career with the Cardinals, hit the pitcher eighth quite a bit. We've seen Ned Yost and the Brewers hit the pitcher eighth at times in recent years. But I'm going to make this differentiation. I think it's very important to do that. When you saw the Cardinals hitting the pitcher eighth, they were batting a guy like a Brendan Ryan or a Daniel Descalso in the ninth spot, a guy who would normally be the number eight hitter in a lineup. In this case, because of the personnel the Marlins have, in my proposal, they'd be hitting D. Gordon, a leadoff man, in the ninth spot. So you have back-to-back leadoff hitters, essentially, with Gordon, then the actual number one hitter, Christian Yelich, to follow him. And what you're doing, again, is you're putting three consecutive on-base threats directly in front of your best hitter, your best RBI man, Giancarlo Stanton, without pushing him down into the fourth spot in the batting order, without costing him a bat in the first inning every night, and without costing many at-bats over the course of the season. Because if you hit third rather than hit fourth, on average you get about 2.5 percent plate appearances more over the course of the season. That adds up over 162 games. When you look at the difference between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs, in some cases it could be one game, and that one game could have been decided by one run. You look for a way to find one more run at some point in a ball game somewhere along the line, and you do that enough over the course of the year, you win yourself several extra ball games, put yourself in a much better position. It's a proposal, something to think about as we move along here over the course of the remainder of the winter and into spring training. Mike Redmond telling us in the show last week that he plans to try a lot of different things out over the course of the spring and see where people are most comfortable. My guess is Red probably not thinking along my lines. But at the end of the day, he's the one who's accountable for these decisions, not me. It's easy for me to sit here and throw stuff like this out, but we'll see how it all plays out. A couple other Marlins notes for you as we move into our final moments together here tonight. You may have seen the report late last night of Ken Rosenthal of FoxSports.com and the MLB Network. Ken Rosenthal reporting that sources tell him, and this is a big deal for the Marlins, that Dan Herron is now prepared to come to spring training with the Marlins. Remember, Herron, the veteran right-hander, 13-game winner for the Dodgers last year, a perennial 30-start, 200-inning pitcher, perennially wins 11, 12, 13, 14 games. Herron had, before the trade, stated his preference to stay on the West Coast. His wife and kids are in the L.A. area. And after he was traded to the Marlins, he said that, well, he might just retire and walk away from $10 million. Now, the Marlins, remember, are protected because the $10 million that Herron is due to make this year was sent to Miami from the Dodgers either to pay Herron if he pitches for the Marlins, or the Marlins have to do whatever they want with in the event that Herron does instead retire. But Dan Herron, according to Ken Rosenthal, while still hoping for a trade, is preparing to come to spring training with the Marlins. And if you think about it, a starting rotation to begin the year with Henderson Alvarez, Matt Latos, Jared Cozart, Dan Herron, and Tom Kohler in it, that's a pretty nice way to head into the season. And remember, you've got Jose Fernandez expected back sometime in June or July. You've got Brad Hand and David Phelps for some depth. You've got potentially Aaron Crow acquired from the Royals. Add some depth. Andre Rienzo, a pitcher who was acquired from the White Sox organization, who the Marlins see as a starter. Got the top prospect, Justin Nicolino, Jose Urena, who we'll see in spring training this year. They'll both most likely start the year at AAA. But there are options if Herron doesn't come. If he does, however, boy, Alvarez, Latos, Cozart, Herron, and Kohler, that's a starting five that you can take into battle and feel pretty good about. The arbitration filing deadline coming up tomorrow. This is something to keep an eye on as a baseball fan. The Marlins able to avoid arbitration with Giancarlo Stanton when he signed that record-breaking contract back in November. They still have seven players who are eligible for salary arbitration this winter. Henderson Alvarez, Steve Cishek, Aaron Crow, Mike Dunn, D. Gordon, Matt Latos, and David Phelps. The salary arbitration filing date is tomorrow. And the deadline to exchange figures between the player and the team is Friday. Marlins have had a policy over the years of going to an arbitration hearing if a deal isn't reached by that exchange deadline on Friday. Those hearings at which an arbiter hears both sides and then chooses either the team's figure or the player's figure. There's nothing in between. Well, those hearings will be held over the course of the first couple of weeks of February. MLB Trade Rumors has developed a method of accurately projecting what players are going to make via arbitration. And according to their model, we can run through what the seven eligible Marlins are projected to make if they get to arbitration here in 2015. Again, these are all players who are under contract. The only question is, how much will they make in 2015? Matt Latos projected to make about $8.4 million. Steve Cishek, $6.9 million to close. Henderson Alvarez, about $4.5 million. D. Gordon expected to make about $2.5 million through arbitration this coming season. Remember, his contract will be paid by the Dodgers. Mike Dunn due to make about $2.3 million. David Phelps about $1.3 million, according to the MLBTradeRumors.com formula they come up with. It's been very accurate over the last several years. And Aaron Crow expected to make about $2 million. Now, there's always a chance that any or all of these players can avoid arbitration by agreeing to a 2015 contract with the Marlins. Agreements can be struck right up until the time the two sides walk into the arbitration hearing in February. But as I mentioned, the Marlins' policy has been to go to the hearing if they can't come to terms by the deadline to exchange figures, which is coming up on Friday. So something to keep an eye on. You may hear some announcements tomorrow that the Marlins have agreed to a 2015 contract with one or more of those players. That's why there's that deadline coming up tomorrow. And they could also agree to a multi-year deal with some of those players potentially, but want to at least get the 2015 salary set in stone. Owners' meetings coming up later this week, Wednesday and Thursday in Phoenix. On the agenda, they're going to discuss Rule 7.13, the rule to protect catchers and eliminate home plate collisions this past year. Will they make any changes to that rule? We might have a much clearer vision of what they're going to do coming out of those meetings Wednesday and Thursday. Going to talk about instant replay, maybe ways to speed that process up, and other ways to speed up the pace of game. What do you think about a pitch clock in Major League Baseball? Pitcher's got 20 seconds from the time he steps on the rubber to let that pitch go. It was experimented with in the Arizona Fall League this past winter. Personally, I don't like the idea. I don't want to be sitting in the radio booth looking down at that pitch clock, counting it down as I wait for an eighth-inning reliever to make a critical pitch in a ball game. But they experimented with it in the Arizona Fall League, and some people liked it. I want to keep hitters in the batter's box between pitches, try to keep the game moving along. Those are some of the things that will be discussed at the owners' meetings Wednesday and Thursday in Phoenix. Rob Manfred has not yet taken over from Bud Selig. Selig's still the commissioner until a little bit later in the month of January, but speeding up the pace of game, it was something that Bud Selig talked about a lot, and the incoming commissioner, Rob Manfred, has said that'll clearly be a priority for him moving into his new role here in 2015 and beyond. Some news of a couple of former Marlins want to pass along. I don't know if you saw this a couple of days ago. Gabby Sanchez headed to play in Japan in 2015 after all or part of 7 years in the big leagues with the Marlins and Pirates. Gabby signed with the Rakuten Golden Eagles. That's a team that Casey McGee played for back in 2013. So Gabby headed to Japan. And former Marlins third base coach Joe Espada has been named the Yankees third base coach and infield instructor. Espada left the Marlins after the 2013 season. He spent 2014 as a special assistant to Yankees GM Brian Cashman. So those are some comings and goings. A couple of former Marlins in the news. Gabby Sanchez to Japan. And Joe Espada joining the coaching staff of the New York Yankees. That music tells us that's all the time we have for this week. Man, we packed a lot into the last 2 hours. I want to thank my guests tonight, Perry Hill, Tom Kohler, and Josh Lewin. Thanks to Kyle Seeloff for his conversations with Dave Van Horn and Cliff Floyd. Thanks for in-studio engineer tonight, Michael Komiak. Once again, thanks to you for joining us for another edition of Marlins Hot Stove. If you missed any of tonight's show or want to go back and listen to past shows, all of our Marlins Hot Stove shows are available online at marlins.com/hotstove. They're also available as free podcasts on the iTunes Store. Don't forget, Marlins Hot Stove returns next Monday night at 7. We'll have more Marlins talk and more Marlins guests. When it comes to the Marlins, keep your radio dial locked right here on your home for Marlins baseball all season and all off-season long, Miami Sports Station, 940 Wins.